And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest, Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's currently the manager of technology formulation for the Space Technology Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He also manages the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts, NIAC. He manages Space Technology Advanced Concepts and the NASA Strategic Technology Research Fellowships, all for JPL. He previously spent 7 years as the chief technologist for the Enterprise Engineering Division at JPL, and he's been working in technology and microelectronic interconnects for more than 35 years. Dr. Shapiro, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
John, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
We always love having you on, and let's start. I mean, it wouldn't be NASA without an acronym. Let's start with PUFR, Pop-Up Folding Explorer Robot. It is fascinating, 3 by 5 inches, 0.6 pounds. Tell us about this technology and the applications for it.
So this is a fun technology that was actually started as a part of a young engineer, early career engineers competition. And JPL had a team consisting of three engineers that were young at the time, maybe not so much anymore, Jaco Karas, Christine Fuller, and Keeland Carpenter, who really took this idea and made a proposal to NASA. They really enjoyed the way that these young people put this proposal together and gave them some funding to explore it, and it's gone on for several iterations since the original funding, and it's turned out to be quite an interesting vehicle. As you said, it's very small. It's only about 2.5 or 3 inches by 4 inches, maybe 0.5 inch thick. Think of it as a small cell phone or a smartphone with kind of 3-inch wheels on each end, and that gives you an idea of how the vehicle looks. We looked originally at several different applications, and we have a very exciting current application. Originally, we were looking at Mars applications, and certainly we're still pursuing those. But since the original development of the PUFR robot, what we found is that NASA was very interested in going back to the moon and getting some idea of how to establish a base on the moon for astronauts. And they needed precursor robotic instruments to find out, kind of explore the area before the astronauts came back and made a much larger investment, and to try to find out what was going on in different areas of the moon to find the best areas for local resources and that kind of thing. NASA's also been very interested in commercial development, and so they put out a competition, one of several competitions. It's called CLIPS, and that competition is for lunar landers, commercial lunar landers. So they put out a call for proposals, and many commercial companies started to compete for opportunities for this lander. I think there was an announcement of 9 companies that went to the next level, and then there will probably be another down selection from there. Anyhow, what we're hoping is to put the PUFR as the payload on one of these commercial landers. Now, the first set of landers is very small, and their total payload is only about 15 kilograms. Now, so that would require a fairly small payload to go into that lander to find out what kinds of things were going on at the moon. And we felt that PUFR was an ideal candidate for this opportunity.
Of course.
So we've been working on a proposal for NASA for this and creating a whole set of operational scenarios for how this PUFR robot might work.
So for our listeners who do not have a picture of PUFR in front of them, and I would encourage them to Google NASA PUFR robot, maybe that'll do it. It's 2 wheels that can crunch down so that it can scoot into a very very narrow or very flat space. It can go up 45 degree. I mean, it's the applications are for maybe when a traditional 2,000-pound rover wouldn't do, this thing can be deployed to go out and jump into a hole and go down and find out what's in the hole. And it's the two wheels are connected to a printed circuit board, which makes it its body. And it just has incredible maneuverability, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And both the ability to climb very steep terrains is one of its great features, and also its kind of robustness. It's very flexible. We've driven it off of 10 meters, it's a little over 30 feet on Earth, and it survives just fine. So in a lunar application with the lower gravity, that would mean that something it could survive easily something like a 50-meter drop. So we're looking, the other exciting thing about it is it gives us the opportunity to explore something called multi-agent autonomy, which means that we can have a whole stack of these. We're looking at somewhere between 5 and 20 of these running around to explore different areas of the lunar surface. And the nice thing about having multi-agents is if one of them is obscured behind a rock or something like that, it could relay information to one of the ones that's visible to the lander, and then that one would relay the information, and the lander would relay the information back to Earth. So it gives us an opportunity to kind of chain communications, which means that we could drive one of these off the edge of a crater or off the edge into a pit, have it go down to the bottom, and then have one at the top that could kind of look down and see the one at the bottom, and then start relaying pictures and scientific information back from the bottom of the pit back to the lander. And a number of the scientists that we talk with think there are actually lava tube-like caves at the bottoms of some of these pits, so we could drive several off and actually drive them into the caves, explore the interior of the caves. And these are potential habitat areas for astronauts because during certain portions of the year and during sun activity, there can be quite a high radiation environment. This might offer a way for the astronauts to form protection without having to build something.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He is the Technology Formulation Manager for the Space Technology Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Boy, do you ever shorten up your title at all? It's kind of a difficult one to shorten, isn't it?
I just take what's given to me.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we all are, to a certain degree, worried about losing our jobs to robots, to artificial intelligence, and things like that. But it sounds like to me that the astronaut is not in danger of losing his or her job anytime soon, but instead will have some increased responsibilities in sort of, managing these robots if, for example, you know, both are traveling to the lunar surface. And what it's sounding like is that the bots that are, what, about 5 ounces, very tiny little things, are just going to increase the efficiency and how nimble the astronauts can be and increasing the level of resources.
Yes, that's exactly correct, Lynn. And what we think is really a useful tool, we're hopefully not going to burden the astronauts with additional tasks, but give them assistance. So we're trying to develop completely autonomous systems so that they can go and explore out on their own. All we have to do is say, go find this kind of target, and they will go out and explore the surface in different directions and relay the information back. We're hoping that they will be able to tell the astronauts where particular resources are. For instance, if we can look for water that's in rocks. We can look for iron. We can look for different mineral resources that may be useful to the astronauts during their exploration, and resources that they may want to use for constructing their own habitats and things that they want to use on the moon. And so this is a way for the astronauts to get information without having to work and go check out themselves and make their own measurements, but they can just send the fleet of these things out, come back with the information, and the astronauts will know where the interesting features are.
Yes. Well, let's move from robots to, well, a different type of robots, that something you call a mechanical worm that, in addition to some of the things you've talked about, would be able to crawl down vents in the surface, not just on the lunar surface, not on the moon, but perhaps Europa. Tell us about that.
That's correct. We have a brilliant researcher named Aaron Parnes, and what he's developed is he looked for the most energy-efficient way to do exploration on what we call ocean worlds or some of these icy moons. Europa or Enceladus are the prime examples that we're looking for. And with Europa and Enceladus, they have these vents that we think go down into the ice and maybe down to water underneath, and we'd like to be able to explore down those vents. And so what Dr. Parnes developed was a robot that looks kind of like operates kind of like an inchworm. Think about a large inchworm. It's currently about 3 inches in diameter and about maybe two to three feet long, although they can make many versions, depends on how many joints. So think about it like kind of like a robot arm with little feet, one on each end. And what Dr. Parnes has done is he's developed a set of what we call gecko grippers, which this is what his dissertation at Stanford was on, and what these grippers do are enable the robot to stick to sheer, flat surfaces like ice. So it can grip onto ice and pull itself up vertical or even walls that are inverted and inch its way up and down very, very rough terrain that would be difficult for any other kind of vehicle to go.
Yeah. Dr. Shapiro, let's talk about 3D printing. There's been a little bit of stuff in the news recently about some 3D printers that can take various alloys in the same printing application, and I believe that NASA is experimenting with that and probably leading the way. Can you talk about that?
Yes, well, NASA does have a substantial effort in 3D printing, particularly with metals. Different NASA centers are looking at different aspects of it. Certainly the folks down in Marshall are looking at printing metals that are appropriate for rocket engines and that kind of thing. The aspect that JPL's leading at this point, and we think it's kind of at the forefront of the industry, are something called gradient alloys. Now, this takes a special kind of additive machine that has, in the case of the ones that we're using, has four different powder bins. So you put in metal powder into these bins, and you can turn on and off the flow of the powder from these bins. It deposits the powder on a surface. And at the same time that it's depositing the powder, a laser comes and melts the powder as it goes along. Now, the nice thing about having four bins is you can put different materials in these four bins. And so that's allowed us to kind of create structures that graduate from one metal to a different metal for different applications. And so the question is, why would you want to do that? It's kind of entertaining that you can go from one metal on one end of an object to a different metal on another end. But people ask me, what would you use that for? And several of the applications we're exploring are very interesting. We've always had a difficulty, NASA-wide had a difficulty going from titanium fuel tanks to the rocket nozzles. Down to a stainless fitting on the rocket nozzles, and that's always been a difficult joint to make. It's very difficult to weld, and what we've been able to do is establish a gradient where we have a gradual change in concentration from the titanium on one side to the stainless steel on the other side, and through that gradual transition, it enables the joint to be much more robust and not have the kinds of problems that we've been having with welding over the years. Another interesting application is the use of something called Invar. And Invar is a metal, it's a nickel steel alloy that has a very interesting characteristic of a zero thermal expansion. And thermal expansion is the property of a material that when you heat up something, almost all materials that we know about and are familiar with, they expand a little bit when you heat them up, and they contract a little bit when you cool them down. And in everyday lives, this doesn't bother us too much. But in space, we get to extreme temperatures. We get to temperatures like minus 270 Celsius, or we can go to Venus and get the temperatures of plus 500 Celsius. So we have these huge temperature ranges that we deal with, and the thermal expansion differences in different materials turn out to be a real problem. That's where a lot of things will fail if they're not designed correctly. What we've been able to do with the gradient alloys is go from a zero expansion material to a normal stainless expansion material, which has an expansion of about 10 parts per million per degree C. And so what this allows us to do is connect materials, like some parts of the spacecraft are made out of carbon composites, which have a very low expansion, near zero, to stainless fittings, which have this expansion of about 10. And by including the gradient from Invar to stainless steel across the connector, the mechanical connector that we use for these things, it allows us to take that difference in expansion, and essentially the stresses are all concentrated in the connector, which we can make fairly robust in a very small area.
Mm.
So it allows us to make things that are much more robust for our extreme operations.
For our eventual colonization of Mars, there's no way we can bring spare parts for all the different possible things that need to be repaired or fixed or replaced. So I'm assuming that we're talking about bringing 3D printing capabilities to the various colonies. Is that correct?
That is correct. And so this is a field in NASA that we called in-situ resource utilization, or ISRU. And what it means is using the materials that are at the location where you're traveling to build the things that you need. And certainly additive manufacturing is being looked at that. The primary work in this area is actually being done, or there's a lot of work being done by Kennedy Space Center and Johnson Space Center both. And what they're actually able to do is they've demonstrated that they can dig up soil, simulant, if you will, of Mars soil, process it using solar concentrators or lasers, and then from that you can extract metal, and from the metal then you can actually refine it and use it to start printing your structure. And they've looked at a variety of ways of doing that, but you can actually use solar power or solar power through solar concentrators, or use solar power through solar panels to power a laser.
Wow. Dr. Shapiro, you know, throughout history, public perception and public support of NASA has somewhat influenced, you know, government support of NASA and funding. And I'm wondering, it's very heartening to me to hear you talk about 3D printers because, you know, we all, well, not all of us, but many of us have used 3D printers. You know, we have one in our local library here. Our kids in high school, maybe even middle and elementary schools, have 3D printers right in their libraries. And so it's something that touches everyone. And so to hear you talk about 3D printing, it's something we can identify with, right? And so I'm wondering, you know, how you make that connection, you know, you're bringing now with this program science to the lay people and hopefully creating science curious. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, sort of bridging the gap between what you do, extremely technological, and the rest of us.
Well, that's a great question, Lynn. We love to have people engaged. We really would like people to know what's going on in NASA. NASA has a substantial outreach program, and if we can do it by engaging folks through 3D printing, that's great. We're actually looking at ways of printing spacecraft themselves. We're looking at printing small CubeSats and small spacecraft, and if we think the public has also provided a lot of ideas in that, and some of our engineers have even put up these shared idea areas where the public can actually submit ideas or contribute to ideas that we use, and sometimes we'll go ahead and print those out. It's also a great tool. We use the plastic printers to print out models of what we think the spacecraft might look like and see how the pieces fit together. And we use those to engage the public as well, because then they can actually pick up a piece of what looks like a spacecraft and actually is the same shape as the spacecraft will be, and see how it looks and see how it feels, and I think it's a great experience.
I love it. Crowdsourcing great ideas. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He is the Manager of Technology Formulation for the Space Technology Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us again. It's great to have you back. Happy holidays, and we'll talk to you hopefully soon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Shapiro.